Welcome to Making a Meal of It, the podcast for eaters of all appetites who want to reimagine and reinvigorate their relationships with food, food culture, and food systems. I'm David Zanto, and I'll be your server today. Do you have any allergies or intolerances? Anything you want me to tell the kitchen? If not, let me tell you about our specials and what's coming up on the menu. Actually, no. Before I do, have a listen to this. That was the sound of you racing through your meal, perhaps consuming more food and drink than you intended, and clearing out your table early enough that another group can be seated before the kitchen closes for the night. It was, of course, the oh-so-dulcet tones of a contemporary busy restaurant, a sonic lullaby that amplifies profitability. Aspects of contemporary restaurant design, from table placement and flow to the atmospheric effects of lighting and sound, are often conceived in ways that subtly, and sometimes not so subtly, encourage eaters to spend more money in less time. Darker and louder spaces apparently make us drink more and eat faster, increasing how much we spend and reducing our time at table. Loud restaurants aren't just annoying, they're actually also psychologically quite manipulative. In some ways, though, we can't really blame restaurateurs for trying to extract as much cash from us as possible. The whole business model is pretty flawed, and as most of us know, restaurants come and go very quickly because the profit margins are just so tight. As a former restaurant investor once told me, "You got $1 million to lose? Open a restaurant." While there have long been places to buy prepared food, ready to eat, and serve to us outside the home, what we currently think of as a restaurant is a relatively new construct. Taverns and inns have existed for centuries, serving travelers and pilgrims around the world. And similarly, street food vendors are a phenomenon as ancient as cities, whether they're offering tripe soup eaten while crouched on a three-legged stool, or freshly fried fish at a portside marketplace, or peeled and chopped fruit from a roadside cart. But the contemporary restaurant as a space for more leisurely, sit-down, multi-course meals is a reality that emerged largely at the end of the 18th century. As Jean-Robert Pitt has written, the restaurant is a convergence of shifts in social class structures of global colonial trade and culinary training, and of course, economic privilege. Whereas the word restaurant originally referred to a meat broth that was intended to restore the energy to a traveler, it eventually came to mean a place where you'd sit down, order your choice of items from a menu, wait to be served, then eat in company or alone, and pay a premium for the luxury of doing so. Restaurants today range from fast food outlets to spaces of performance art where diners spend many hours and multiple hundreds of dollars a head. And restaurant chefs have become celebrities, media moguls, authors, spokespeople, and of course then credited as artists or innovators and sometimes even activists. Underlying all that restaurants have become is the idea of added value. We go to restaurants because they offer something we cannot or do not want to provide for ourselves. Hot or prepared food away from home, service that makes us feel special and attended to, or dishes with ingredients or techniques that we don't have access to. And then for all this, we cough up as much as 5 or 10 times the price of the base materials. But over the last years, restaurant economics have gotten ever more complicated. The recognition that serving and cooking staff deserve equivalent pay and a fair wage has thrown both salary and tipping debates into overdrive, and the rising cost of supplies and rent and utilities means that a night for two at a taqueria can cost $100. Meanwhile, the shifting labor market brings new challenges as highly trained chefs and experienced servers bail out for less demanding work environments. What we're sometimes left with are folks who just don't care or don't have the know-how to cook and serve food at the level that a 400% markup really demands. Simply put, restaurants are, well, complex. In today's episode, I'm talking with a former restaurant cook and co-owner who has reset his sights on what he calls social gastronomy, as well as a food service designer with a PhD in consumer behavior. Then, during the Stick This In Your Mouth segment, Maxime and I go humble with a simple but maybe controversial food item, and closing things off, a multi-talented artist-performer responds to the food questionnaire. First up, Dr. Stephanie Robson, who shares her expertise in restaurant design and consumer behavior through a consulting and teaching practice. She has a master's degree in design and environmental analysis and a PhD in environmental psychology, both from Cornell University. She regularly works in educational and commercial settings, helping to create and optimize hospitality environments. Well, Stephanie, thank you so much for being part of this podcast. I'm delighted to make your acquaintance and talk to you about the weird, wonderful world of restaurants.
I am delighted to be here, David. Thank you for having me.
So in one of your bios, you're described as a specialist in the psychology of restaurants. And that struck me as a kind of fascinating term. Can you tell me more about what that means?
Sure. We think about psychology, right, as the study of people's behaviors and attitudes and beliefs. Well, I look at how that relates to people's responses to restaurants. So what about a restaurant makes people feel a certain way or behave a certain way? I sort of stay away from the beliefs part, but I really focus on the behavior part.
Yeah, well, and we tend to think of restaurants as places that serve food, but don't necessarily serve, well, sometimes they serve attitude, but don't necessarily serve us opportunities for modifying our behavior or influencing our behavior. They're not neutral spaces, are they?
They're definitely not neutral spaces because we choose to go to a restaurant, right? It's a completely choice-driven activity. And so anytime you have a choice, there's a behavior that goes along with it. And if that's the case, you can actually affect that behavior with choices that the restaurateur makes, whether it's about what they serve or the kind of experience they craft with the design. It's all based on getting people to make certain choices.
That point, the design of a given restaurant has enormous impact on the experience of the eaters. It can influence the way that we even think we're tasting the food. What are some of the most intriguing parts of a restaurant design that can have an effect on the consumer?
Well, my main focus is on seating. Not just the seat that you're sitting in, but the table you're sitting at and where it is and how big it is and what you can see from that table. That's kind of the focus. To me, that is something the restaurateur has almost complete control over. Mm-hmm. Because if you think about other parts of the design, things like the lighting and even the sound, there are things the restaurateur can do to control some of that, but they can't control all of it because there's going to be conditions that occur because of the guests in the restaurant. But with the seating, they have complete control over it. And for that reason, you can probably have more effect on the guest with the seating. That said, when I go into a restaurant, I'm horrible to go out with because I'm always sort of spinning my head around looking at what's the lighting and what do I hear and what colors have they used. But in all honesty, to me, it's the seating and the table that make the most difference.
So when it comes to seating, is it a question of how the tables and chairs are set out? Is it about the actual material aspects of those tables and chairs, whether they're low, high, comfortable with arms, or is it more about that, the way they're arranged in the room?
It's a bit of everything. The arrangement piece, we could talk all day about where people choose to sit and what that means for the experience they have. And the thing about a lot of restaurants is sometimes you don't get to choose where you sit, right? The host or the maitre d' or whatever term you want to use will select a table for you. And they have lots of reasons for choosing the table that they do. And where you sit at that table, though, imagine it's a table for four and you're there with three friends. Which seat you end up sitting in, there's a lot of choices that go into that. But I think the element of where the seat is, what you're up against. So what I mean by that is architecturally, are you up against a wall, up against a structural column? Is your table floating out in the middle of the room and you're not up against anything? Those are all things that are going to influence your experience, even though you may not be aware of it.
Well, what are some of those influences? Because I know when I go into a restaurant, if I'm sitting with my back to the wall, I feel a little bit more secure. I feel a little bit more grounded. Are there general norms across the board for people, or is it very individual?
There are mostly norms, but there are some variations. And you'll be happy to know, David, you are perfectly normal if you want to sit with your back against something. Most people do. And, you know, think about it. It's partially because of how our eyes are positioned in our heads. We don't have good peripheral vision. And so we prefer to be able to see what's approaching us. If you look at an animal like a rabbit or a deer, those are prey animals and they have their eyes on the sides of their head. So they prefer to be out in the open so that they can see if something bad's coming. We like to protect our backs. So it's really deeply rooted in not just in our behaviors, but also deep in our wiring of our brains. Mm-hmm. But there are some situations and some cultures that actually see a space that's more exposed as being higher status.
Oh, because you're more visible.
Yeah, that's higher status. Whereas in North American culture, that scene is feeling more exposed and not quite as comfortable. And there are, might be some dining experiences where you want to be exposed, right? It's your birthday party and you're there with 16 other people that are all your best friends, and you're going to be having a lot of fun and making a lot of noise. Being in the middle of the space is fine under those circumstances. But if it's an intimate dinner for two, and then maybe there's a difficult conversation you're going to have, you want to be tucked in a corner so you have as much anchoring, as much physical structure around you as possible, so that you feel the comfort you were just describing when you don't want to feel exposed to people around you.
So what are the effects of, say, feeling secure and comfortable and protected in a restaurant in terms of eater behavior?
Well, for one thing, you'll probably stay longer. And for a restaurant, that can be a blessing and a curse. Restaurants, people think about restaurants as selling food and drink, but really what they're doing is they're renting space. They're renting space to you, and the rent that you pay is what you buy. And when a restaurant is really busy and there's a lot of people waiting for a table, the restaurant probably doesn't want you to stay a long time. They would like you to turn the table so they can get the next party in. But if it's the end of the evening or the restaurant's not that busy, the longer you stay, in many cases, the more you'll spend.
I'd also understood at one point that darker restaurants and restaurants with louder and faster tempo music tend to encourage consumers to also eat more and eat faster, and they also therefore get out quicker. Is that part of what you're interested in as well?
I am interested. I've seen the research about the speed of the music. Absolutely. In fact, there's a really interesting study. It wasn't even done in a restaurant. It was done in a wine store, where they manipulated the music without informing the staff of the wine store what they were doing, which is really important. They manipulated the music to see if they could change people's wine buying behavior. Mm-hmm. And it worked really well. In that case, it wasn't so much the speed of the music, but the style of the music that was played influenced the type of wine people bought. And right down to whether they were playing, and these were all instrumentals, they weren't including vocals, but music from different countries actually influenced the purchase of wine from that country.
I mean, it's surprising and not surprising, because of course we make all sorts of sensory associations every minute of every day without even being aware of them. And that must come down to also our interest or our expectation for the taste of the thing that we're about to buy and then consume.
Exactly. And you said something about the lighting. I have not seen any research that suggests that if the lighting is low, that people will buy more. They will drink more, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to buy more food. One issue with low lighting is everybody looks better in low lighting, and anything you can do to make your guest feel better about themselves usually is a good thing.
Okay.
As long as you can find that sweet spot where the lighting isn't so low that those of us who are of a certain age can actually read the menu. There's nothing more frustrating than having to take whatever light fixture there is on the table and hold it up to your menu so you can see what you're ordering.
Right, right. Or use your phone in fact, these days, a lot of menus are on phones. So that's a moot question. So with the darkness and the more drinking, what's the connection there?
It's reduction in your inhibitions.
Okay.
There's this part of our wiring, again, that when it's dark, we feel like we're less exposed. People can't see us. And so we're perhaps more likely to be more open to doing things we wouldn't do in bright light. I'll let your mind wander as to what those things could be. But generally, if you have lower light levels, people feel more relaxed. And there's lots of research about light levels and people's heart rate and the color of the lighting and people's heart rate, even how long they perceive the passage of time based on the actual color tone of the lighting. But a lot of restaurants, if they want you to stay a while and relax and feel comfortable and order that second cocktail, they're going to have lower lighting. They're going to have, you know, music that is cohesive with their concept, and they're going to give you a really comfy chair.
What percentage of restaurants do you think are participating actively in manipulating the design of their space in this way to encourage longer or shorter or more eating time?
Oof, that's a great question. I don't have any data. My gut tells me it is by no means the majority. Is it 20%? I would say restaurants that hire professional designers may be more likely to know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. The designers, one hopes, have some exposure to some of this research, or even just based on their own experience as designers. And I've worked with some restaurateurs that are aware of some of these effects. But you and I have both been to restaurants that clearly they have not read any of this research.
Oh, yes.
And they are, you know, they're just making their business run as best they can. And they may not be thinking about the sort of atmospheric element of the dining experience. Their focus is what's happening on the plate. And there's all kinds of research that shows people say that the food is really important to them. But when it actually comes down to what restaurant they choose and why, the food's down the list and the atmosphere is actually quite high.
Flipping the focus a bit for a second, we've been talking about how consumers are affected, how the eater is affected by the spatial design or the table layout or the atmospherics. But what about the workers, the staff in restaurants? What kind of effects are there on them based on the ways that the space is designed?
There's a lot that people don't realize. One of them is whether the servers can see their tables from their stations. So if you think about your classic full service dining experience, you've got a server who might be responsible for 4 or 5 tables, and yet the service station or where they're picking up the food or whatever is tucked away and they can't see their tables. They can't pace the meal. And if you want your guests to have a great experience, your server has to be right on top of, you know, where are you in your meal? When should they ask for the next element, or when should they pick up the next element and drop it to your table? If the server can't see the table, they can't do as good a job. This goes also for the host, right? The host is managing the flow, not just of seating the guests, but really they're responsible for the flow of what's happening in the kitchen. Because if they seat a whole bunch of people in the same section at the same time, the kitchen's going to get backed up. And I know everyone says, oh, there's software. They can look at their table management system. But if you can just turn your head and see, you're not relying on software. And you're probably going to do a more effective and faster job than staring at a screen.
Well, that suddenly is everything's starting to crystallize for me as I think about, oh, the waiter hasn't been around in an hour place. And ding, the waiter is right there and has noticed that it is time to clear. Everyone's finished. We haven't waited too long. And that must be a sightline thing. But I'd never thought about it. Because often, you know, the waiter's coming by every 5 seconds to say, is everything okay? Is everything okay? I guess that means that they don't have great sightlines from everywhere that they are. And they have to do that circuit. So it's more walking for them, but it's also more their presence during your meal. And sometimes that invisible waiter or server is more appreciated, the one who pops up just at the right moment instead of coming by every few minutes.
Yeah. And that's a design decision. People don't realize that when you're designing any kind of space where you have service, whether it's a restaurant or a hospital or you name it, there's all these elements of both sight lines and travel time. Another thing you'd asked about when how the design of a restaurant affects the servers. Another one is the actual size of the table. Mm. So I was in Montreal last week. And I went to a restaurant with a friend, and we were seated at a high top round table in the window. And we both ordered the same thing, which was moules frites, right? Mussels and French fries on the side. Well, when you order that dish, you have the bowl of mussels, and then you have the bowl for the shells, mm-hmm. and then you have the French fries. And then, of course, we had a glass of wine because you must. Well, we both had that, and we were sitting at this table that could not accommodate it.
Right.
So in the middle of our meal, our server, as they came to the table with these dishes, went, oh, we've got a problem. And they actually had to move us to another table in the middle of our meal so that we could actually eat the things that we had ordered. You know, they were charming about it, and we laughed. But my brain was, of course, going tick, 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 tick. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When you're designing the restaurant, you have to look at your menu and vice versa. And if you're making a choice about table size based on, I want to get as many seats in the restaurant as I can. Let's make a small table. And then you have this circumstance. You've set yourself up for all kinds of problems. And now you've got this issue of, I have to have a second table to move these guests to because they couldn't have their meal at the table we assigned to them.
How many of us have spent hours or minutes anyway, rearranging little dishes on our tables and our wine glasses and holding things here and there while the waiter helps us find the space for those things? That's, you know, it's obvious. And then it's also so not obvious, I suppose, when you're actually sitting out to design the space.
Exactly. There's this, what I call the waiter panic face. You know, they come to your table and there's this little moment where their eyes bug out and they think, oh, how am I going to do this and do this elegantly?
Yeah, even more respect for our friends who serve us food in our restaurants. Yeah.
Please tip them well. Mm-hmm, please tip mm-hmm. them well.
Or let's get rid of tipping altogether and figure out a better solution. But that's a conversation, I think, for another day.
It is. It's a complicated topic.
Although on that subject, what are you seeing? You've been working in this world of restaurants for a long time. You've got multiple perspectives as an academic, as a designer, as a consultant. What, if anything, are you seeing as sort of major shifts in terms of the ways the restaurants are doing business and having to face new realities vis-a-vis their clients?
Well, the one that I'm seeing, and it makes me sad, is the movement away from service and the movement to everything being sort of mediated by technology. You order your food using a tablet or a phone, you know, the ubiquitous QR code. But the getting away from service is partially a survival tactic for the restaurant, because getting and keeping staff is so difficult. And you know, you mentioned the tipping issue. This is a very difficult job, and we want to make sure people are fairly compensated for the work they do and recognized for the importance of the role that they play in the guest experience. And for many restaurants, their math, the way they've set up their restaurant business, doesn't allow them to adequately compensate the service. And so they have two choices. They can either take the service away and make the guests do more and more, or they can rethink their entire business structure. And that may require moving to a different location or a different menu approach.
Yeah, this is something that I've been certainly witnessing myself and feeling sad about, because of course, an extraordinary server makes a meal even more extraordinary. That sense of, oh, I've connected with the food, I've connected with the humans, I've somehow connected with the kitchen through this person who has bridged those two spaces between back of house and front of house.
I will say one thing that's positive, at least to me, is restaurants are getting away from communal tables. There was this perception that they added a liveliness to the dining room, but guests don't like them. They really don't like them. And the movement away and getting more towards the kind of seating that guests do like, which is booth seating, especially post-COVID, right? People wanted to have their own little space. We know from research that booths, people prefer them. They spend more money per minute when they sit in a booth. So if I can put you in a booth and you're happy and you're spending lots of money and you're going to come away with a great experience, the booth is going to be the way to go. And they actually are a better use of space than a table that's just sitting on the floor, what I'll call a floating table.
I think about booths in diners, but even booths in the new sort of swanky retro restaurants, there's a sense of old worldliness to it. And also that comfort, that security, that sense of being protected and in a nice little nest for the time of the meal.
So you mentioned sort of the old world. We used to do this because restaurants weren't necessarily just about food. They were about celebrating an occasion or cementing a relationship. And if we think about restaurants in that way, that they're a social space where things happen, back to your earlier point about trends and this move towards technologically mediated dining, that loses the whole sort of social aspect of what dining is supposed to be.
Well, and as all things change, including the psychology of human beings and our expectations for privacy and publicity and all the other ways that we want to be in the world, we'll see what happens. And I will now be looking around even more when I go to a restaurant next time. Thank you so much, Stephanie.
You're so welcome. And I'm so sorry I've ruined you when next time you go to a restaurant.
Oh, well, I'm getting ruined in so many ways. Why stop at one?
Thanks so much.
To learn more about what Stephanie's doing and thinking, check out her LinkedIn profile or listen to her on the NPR Planet Money podcast episode that rethinks small restaurant economics. I've linked to both of these in the show notes. Next on the podcast is Christophe Dubois, a former restaurant co-owner and cook who now studies and practices social gastronomy. For Christophe, preparing food is a way to acquire confidence and a sense of belonging, to bring transformation to political and environmental contexts, and to increase solidarity among diverse communities of people. When we spoke, he was dividing his time between a master's degree in social work, putting together plans for a TV miniseries on social gastronomy, and working in the field, making communities more resilient through food.
Bon, alors, bonjour Christophe, merci d'être ici, merci, bienvenue au podcast. Ben, merci. C'est ça.
Je vais lancer directement dans la question. Tu as eu un parcours remarquable dans le monde de la cuisine, incluant une période comme cuisinier, comme copropriétaire d'un restaurant exceptionnel, plusieurs engagements avec des groupes communautaires, et maintenant tu poursuis une maîtrise en gastronomie sociale.
Ouais, dans le département de travail social à l'UQAM. Okay. En fait, j'ai commencé après le secondaire, j'ai fait l'ITHQ parce que comme ben du monde de mon âge, j'ai été un peu frappé, obnubilé par cette espèce de comme renouveau gastronomique. Je pense que des hommes comme Martin Picard ont joué un rôle important là-dedans, là, au tournant des années 2000-2010, de comme espèce de redécouverte, j'ai l'impression, là, ou une démocratisation avec comme plein d'émissions de télé, une gastronomie peut-être plus accessible. Fait que j'ai commencé 2010 à l'ITHQ.
Donc, l'Institut de tourisme et hôtellerie du Québec.
Exact.
Okay, ouais. Merci. Montréal, pour nos auditeurs qui ne viennent pas d'ici.
Ouais, exact. Et puis, après ça, un parcours de quelques années en cuisine. Mais rapidement, j'ai senti que j'étais à ma place, mais il y a toujours eu un malaise, un inconfort à certaines normes, à certaines manières de faire, une espèce d'ambiance un peu assez militaire, on pourrait dire là.
Ouais. Donc, le système de brigade.
Le système de brigade, tu sais, puis on pourra peut-être revenir un peu plus sur cette espèce de construction là, tu sais, d'ambiance puis de manière de faire dans les cuisines. C'est ça, tu sais, après quelques années à cuisiner dans un restaurant magnifique.
C'était Lilico.
Au Lilico, ouais. Exactement.
Un de mes restaurants préférés de tout le temps, tous les endroits du monde, c'était exceptionnel.
Ouais, c'est sûr que je suis super biaisé, parce que, non seulement j'avais des parts, mais c'est vraiment cet endroit-là qui m'a fait tomber en amour complètement avec la cuisine, le monde de la restauration, avec David et Catherine, les deux propriétaires là, principaux, là, les deux visages du restaurant. Puis il y avait une force qui m'a attiré vers David, vers la cuisine. Puis je me suis dit, il faut que j'apprenne à cuisiner avec ce gars-là. Puis même si c'est bien moins payant, même si c'est beaucoup d'heures de cuisine, puis des ambiances pas faciles, des rushs incroyables, j'ai appris à cuisiner avec, je crois, un des grands chefs de Montréal qui a aussi, à mon avis, peut-être pas eu assez de reconnaissance, mais bon, ça c'est mon avis personnel, mais c'est parce que c'est mon...
Mais moi je suis d'accord.
C'est mon mentor, c'est mon idole. Ouais. Puis je me suis dirigé vers le travail social après ça. J'ai fait le bac, je suis à la maîtrise, mais j'ai toujours eu pour moi l'intention, le besoin d'être proche de la nourriture, proche de la cuisine. J'ai quitté les cuisines, mais je pouvais pas complètement quitter le monde de la bouffe.
Ouais.
Puis de petit à petit, ben j'ai commencé à donner des cours de cuisine dans un centre communautaire de Parc Extension. Après ça, on a monté un restaurant communautaire avec un organisme qui s'appelle Singa Québec. On a monté le projet Un rêve dans votre assiette, qui avait comme objectif d'employer des femmes qui sont arrivées au Québec comme réfugiées. On les engageait comme cuisinières, comme chefs. Moi, je les accompagnais dans ce parcours-là. Donc, on a monté le projet du restaurant ensemble avec une coopérative de solidarité qui s'appelle La Place Commune dans Parc Extension encore. Puis ça a été un super beau projet, là, 2 ans, presque 3, avec des femmes de plein de nationalités où on a appris à cuisiner ensemble. Puis c'était tout un projet de création de liens. Puis pour moi, c'est là que le travail gastronomique, l'acte gastronomique a pris tout son sens. C'était très, très raw comme gastronomie. Tu sais, c'est la personne, la bouffe, that's it. Il n'y a rien de superflu.
Donc, tellement. Quand tu parles de la gastronomie sociale, c'est vraiment ce mélange de travail social et de la cuisine, la gastronomie, l'appartenance et le goût individuel, mais aussi culturel.
La gastronomie sociale, c'est un concept, je dirais plus une pratique en ce moment, avant d'être un concept, parce que c'est pas tellement étudié, mais c'est beaucoup pratiqué. Puis on la pratique de différentes manières. En ce moment, c'est beaucoup les entrepreneurs sociaux, les chefs qui la pratiquent. Donc toujours avec une optique de charité, de tu sais quelque chose de caritatif, de normatif aussi, de bien manger, de bien produire, de un objectif pédagogique aussi, d'apprentissage. Pour moi, la gastronomie sociale, c'est une gastronomie qui est raisonnée, qui est réfléchie surtout, puis qui a une compréhension holistique de sa place dans un système. Dans le Social Gastronomy Movement, qui est un regroupement international d'acteurs, d'actrices de la gastronomie sociale, on en parle de bien des manières différentes. Mmh. Il y a des trucs avec lesquels moi je suis moins d'accord ou qui me dérangent plus, parce que, mais en même temps, je pense que c'est ce qui fait la beauté aussi de ce mouvement-là, c'est que c'est une pluralité de pratiques en construction. Mmh. Puis donc il y a un potentiel immense à la gastronomie sociale parce qu'on est en train de la construire, on est en train de la pratiquer. On fait des essais, des erreurs, mais il y a cette espèce d'intention-là de faire, d'utiliser la gastronomie, la nourriture, le système alimentaire au service de l'humain, puis de l'utiliser comme un espèce d'outil de développement social, de développement communautaire, de développement collectif pour le bien commun. Donc pour moi, ce que ça traduit, c'est que c'est une volonté de mettre en place une gastronomie qui exemple de l'ego, des espèces d'intentions de compétition, de performance, okay, pour ramener quelque chose d'égalitaire, de solidaire, de communautaire dans le plaisir, dans le partage, dans la collectivité.
Donc, tu as commencé à parler des problèmes que tu as rencontrés dans les restos en termes de relations sociales, en termes de relations de pouvoir.
Ouais.
Tu m'en parlais un peu de ça?
Ben, comme on a dit, comme tu as effleuré rapidement au début, tu sais, la brigade culinaire est un calque de la brigade militaire, une construction de Escoffier, un chef français là, au tournant des années 1850. Un grand chef qui a un peu mis sur la carte l'idée d'une gastronomie très, très normée, standardisée, rigide, le contrôle des recettes, des pratiques et tout ça. Donc vraiment un calque des pratiques militaires où il n'y a rien qui est laissé au hasard. Tu parles à une personne, c'est une hiérarchie, tu sais, une espèce de ligne de commande là, très 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 rigide, un problème de violence aussi, puis de dureté, de rigidité, de machisme. Donc tout ça a calqué la pratique gastronomique qui est partie de la France, puis qu'on voit là, qu'on a vu là se gangréner, parce que ça c'est mon parti pris, mais se gangréner partout dans les systèmes gastronomiques mondiaux, de rigidité, de violence là, de si tu peux pas supporter la chaleur, sort de la cuisine, c'est des pratiques qui sont un peu comme intouchables, on dirait. J'ai eu un glimpse de ça aussi dans mon éducation. J'ai été témoin, tu sais, de paroles, de manières de penser, de manières de faire. Il y avait, c'était pas de la violence, tu sais, je peux pas dire que c'était violent. Tu sais, c'est pas des coups de poing, mais c'est plus des injonctions, tu sais, des manières de penser, des manières de faire qui induisent là, des comportements. Puis c'est un système d'oppression plus ou moins subtil qui perdure depuis longtemps.
Et c'est systémique, c'est complètement implanté dans la compréhension, l'éducation,
exactement,
les pratiques.
Puis non seulement c'est implanté, puis je sais pas, tu sais, à partir de quand on en a fait quelque chose de glamour, mais est-ce que c'est avec l'avènement de certains médias sociaux, de télé-réalité sur les cuisines, on parle beaucoup de Hell's Kitchen, de Gordon Ramsay, mais c'est un personnage médiatique, tu sais, c'est pas Gordon Ramsay dans l'intimité, mais il y a ça a participé, tu sais, à la création d'une vision, puis d'un romantiser, tu sais,
le machisme,
tu sais, d'en faire quelque chose de presque cool d'une certaine manière, tu sais, puis de non, on accepte comme ça, c'est tough, on va vivre dans cette espèce de douleur là, le cook guilt là, il faut comme travailler plus fort, puis c'est une espèce de mélange, tu sais, de toutes ces espèces d'injonctions avec l'entrepreneuriat aussi, les espèces de super entrepreneurs qui se lèvent à 4h du matin pour aller workout, qui vont compter leurs calories, qui vont faire ci, qui deviennent des espèces de super héros des temps modernes, super modèles, super entrepreneurs, super riches, super tout. Puis là, couplé au modèle de la restauration, où en plus d'être tout ça, ben t'es un cuisinier top modèle, plein de tatous, qui a plein de restaurants, super businessman, qui est successful dans tout. Puis que, ben, turns out que t'as un côté un petit peu cray-cray de « Ah, t'es un petit peu violent, mais en même temps, on va te praise parce que c'est de l'intensité, t'as un doute, c'est pas violent, tu sais, c'est de l'intensité, mais quelque chose d'hyper toxique, d'hyper masculiniste, d'hyper machiste. »
Et puis pour les gens qui veulent pas travailler dans un environnement comme ça, il y a pas beaucoup d'options, mais il y en a, mais pas beaucoup, et c'est tellement répandu que c'est normalisé.
Oui, c'est ça. C'est normalisé, c'est ancré, c'est... puis c'est valorisé d'une certaine manière. Mais je pense qu'au Québec, il y a un tournant. Je pense qu'on est en train de, depuis quelques années, de voir des changements, de vivre certains changements, notamment avec des chefs comme Colombe Saint-Pierre, qui amènent une vision différente, je dirais beaucoup plus, je vais pas dire féminine, mais je dirais féministe, mm-hmm. à la cuisine. Une manière différente de communiquer, tu sais, avec plus de notions de care, pas seulement pour l'ambiance dans la cuisine, mais le produit aussi, tu sais, de cuisiner avec des intentions, de pas être le nouveau top chef ou la nouvelle mm-hmm. top chef, mais juste de bien cuisiner dans le plaisir aussi, dans le fun, ouais. pour que ça se ressente, tu sais, puis que tu viennes pas cuisiner, tu viennes pas au travail avec la boule au ventre parce que tu vomis de stress, parce que tu sais que tu vas te faire bully ou quelque chose, tu sais. Juste de créer des ambiances qui sont différentes, ça, je pense que c'est un gros, gros step. Mm-hmm. Je pense qu'il y a des mouvements aussi pour le mangeur aussi, la mangeuse, de manger autrement au restaurant, mm-hmm. de manière peut-être moins expéditive, de choisir les endroits où on va, de savoir que je vais passer ma soirée là, tu sais, puis on va pas dans des restaurants où on va tourner 12 fois les tables, puis tu sais que les cuisiniers en arrière, là, ça a comme ça goal pas possible. Je sais pas, un espèce de changement de mentalité, mm-hmm. de quelque chose de plus relax, plus smooth. Est-ce que dans le monde, ça change? Je sais ouais. pas. J'espère que oui.
Et le monde est... C'est un endroit assez large.
C'est très, très vaste, tu sais. Mais on peut imaginer que tant aussi longtemps qu'il y a une urgence d'agir dans les restaurants, que tant aussi longtemps qu'il y a des reconnaissances qui sont tellement, je dirais, trop importantes, comme des étoiles, mm-hmm. des étoiles Michelin, des petites ces reconnaissances-là hyper prestigieuses qui mettent la pression à pu finir, il va toujours y avoir une certaine forme d'oppression. Dans les cuisines.
Est-ce que tu penses que la politique peut entrer dans le changement nécessaire dans le domaine des restaurants? Est-ce que, par exemple, un parti politique pourrait être utile? Peux-tu me parler du parti politique que tu as co-fondé ici?
Ouais, donc en 2018, on a fondé parce qu'on voyait les élections de 2018 arriver. Ben, le système alimentaire, c'est aussi et surtout un système politique. Il y a des limites à ce qu'on peut faire individuellement, puis on se dit, ben, il faut qu'on émène l'alimentation puis le discours de gastronomie sociale au niveau politique. Donc, on a co-créé avec d'autres personnes quand même le Parti culinaire du Québec.
Le Parti culinaire du Québec, OK.
À ma connaissance, je pense qu'on est le seul parti culinaire au monde. Mm-hmm. Il y a Gaston Acurio au Pérou qui a eu un impact politique important il y a une quinzaine d'années peut-être. Ouais. Mais qui s'est pas lancé en politique. Nous, on l'a fait. Tout ça, oui, pour dire que, ben non, la gastronomie, l'alimentation, le système alimentaire, c'est politique. Oui, ce serait important le jour où on va être au pouvoir.
Oui!
Dans quelques années, là, deux ans, selon deux ans. Nos prédictions. On va s'asseoir avec tout le monde, tu sais, puis si l'idée, c'est de repenser pourquoi ça fonctionne pas dans les restos, tu sais. On sait qu'à Montréal, il y en a beaucoup. On sait que... ça fonctionne pas dans ben des restaurants, ni financièrement, ni émotivement, tu sais, c'est une pression pour tout le monde, fait, comme industrie.
Donc vous avez créé une plateforme politique pour ce parti?
Oui, une plateforme, c'est gros, un manifeste, on a un document Word qui tient sur quelques pages de qu'est-ce qu'on veut en faire. Je pense que l'idée, c'est surtout de ramener la question de l'alimentation dans les sphères politiques, puis de dire que ben la bouffe, c'est pas vrai que c'est quelque chose d'individuel, c'est pas vrai que c'est juste quand on sort les stats de l'inflation, on va se donner 2-3 astuces de comment réduire sa facture d'épicerie en cuisinant plus, en achetant moins de produits transformés, mm-hmm. c'est pas que ça, tu sais. C'est des choix politiques, c'est des interrogations sur l'environnement, sur les modèles entrepreneuriaux aussi qui ouais. nous entourent.
Donc c'est ludique comme concept, mais c'est sérieux.
C'est super sérieux parce que l'alimentation, c'est quelque chose qui touche tout le monde. Mm. Puis tu sais, le bottom line de tout ça, c'est de dire, ben, est-ce qu'on arrive tout le monde à bien manger chaque jour ici au Québec? On commence avec le Québec. Mais si la réponse c'est non, on n'arrive pas tout le monde à bien manger au Québec, il y a un problème mm-hmm. majeur. Ouais. Puis il y a, selon nous, rien de plus important. on commence avec ça, puis le jour où ça se sera réglé, ben on ira voir des questions secondaires. Mais nous, c'est de dire que non, c'est très sérieux. C'est pas parce que on se prend pas au sérieux que la question est pas sérieuse. Mm-hmm. On sait très bien qu'on n'arrivera jamais au pouvoir avec ça.
Puis... Mais vous avez eu combien de votes pendant les élections?
Aux premières élections de 2018, on a eu, je pense, quelque chose comme 100 quelques votes.
OK.
Puis au deuxième, on a eu 300 quelques votes. Fait qu'on a doublé non seulement le nombre de votes, mais on a doublé le nombre de candidats aussi. On est passé de 1 à 2.
Wow! Donc, c'est la croissance exponentielle.
Oui, avec un candidat homme et une candidate femme. Donc, on a une parité exemplaire au sein de notre parti.
Ouais.
Et une croissance. Je ne sais pas s'il y a beaucoup de partis qui doublent comme ça, élection après élection. Ouais. On reste quand même le parti avec le moins de votes dans l'ensemble du Québec.
Okay.
Mais avec...
C'est le début.
C'est un début. Puis tant que, puis on a réussi quand même à avoir une entente entre Gabriel Nadeau-Dubois et Éric Duhaime, quand même, sur s'ils devaient voter pour un parti qui est pas le leur, pour qui ils voteraient. Puis ils ont dit chef Témis, parce que c'est un parti qui fait consensus.
Ouais.
Je pense qu'il ramène des questions tellement simples.
Mais bien fait.
Ben merci. On était très fiers.
Le système politique avec beaucoup de collaboration et d'accord entre les extrêmes.
Oui, je pense que puis tu sais de dire que on sait pas ce qu'on fait, on n'est pas sérieux, mais on n'a pas le choix de le faire aussi.
Ouais.
Puis comme on sait pas ce qu'on fait, on a besoin de tout le monde pour le faire.
Mm-hmm.
On va le faire ensemble. On va penser à un système politique basé sur l'alimentation ensemble parce qu'on n'y connaît rien. On a besoin de tout le monde. Mais la question, c'est quoi l'impact sur notre bouffe, sur nos manières de manger à tout le monde? Tout le monde mange, OK. C'est quoi la deuxième question? C'est quoi la deuxième priorité?
Mm-hmm. Peut-être c'est au peuple de décider.
Exact. Fait que c'est ça. C'est très simple comme plateforme, comme question.
Ben, vous avez ma vote dans la prochaine élection.
Il va nous falloir un candidat ici.
Je vais me déménager pour que je puisse voter pour
moi. Peut-être tu pourrais te présenter. Peut-être tu pourrais être candidat.
Peut-être. Je suis tellement politique.
L'invitation est lancée, hein?
Okay. Ben, merci beaucoup d'être ici, d'avoir parlé de ton parcours dans ce monde d'alimentation et de tous les projets à l'avenir qui vont sûrement changer le monde.
Merci beaucoup. Merci. Yeah.
Take a look at the show notes for links to information about the Culinary Party of Quebec, as well as an interview with Christophe about the transformative and unifying power of food.
Well, Maxime, welcome to this very humble edition of Stick This in Your Mouth.
Why is it humble?
Well, we're going to have something very simple, but kind of fundamental.
Oh, yeah? Fundamental.
Yeah, it's fun and demental. No, it's bread and butter.
Oh, yes.
Bread and butter. It's my bread and butter. It's an old expression. It means it's my basic income. It's what keeps me going.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of expressions with bread and butter because it is such a fundamental staple in eating.
Yes.
But, listeners, Maxime has a secret to tell you.
I don't eat bread and butter.
Why not?
I don't like it.
Why not?
It comes from... No, I should rephrase this. I am not a fan of toasted bread with butter because it melts and then the bread is wet.
You don't like wet bread.
I don't like wet bread.
Okay, but what about just plain old like bread and butter? You sit down at a nice bistro, they bring you... Well, they don't anymore, and that's part of the point of this episode. But, you know, in the past, we used to sit down at a table in a nice restaurant and they'd bring you freshly cut bread or maybe rolls and some butter.
Yes. It's like associated young with the butter not being desirable on toast to butter not being desirable.
Hmm.
So I just don't put butter on my bread if there is bread served at a table.
And now I'm trying to think, when we're at a restaurant and they serve bread, do you eat the bread?
I do eat the bread. I love bread.
Just no butter on it.
Just no butter on it.
Because we were actually at a restaurant in Saint-Georges in the Beauce last weekend.
Yes.
A kind of fancy upscale restaurant.
Yeah.
And for the first time in a very long time, they brought us out a plate of slices of baguette and some very delicious butter in beautifully little textured balls.
That's true.
And I was totally surprised.
Yes, because very rarely do they do it anymore in restaurants.
Yeah, and it's one of the just standard cost-cutting measures that have gone swept across the restaurant scene in the last, 2 to 4 to 6 years?
Mm-hmm.
It just seems like free bread and butter ain't there anymore. In fact, it's probably been about 10 years that really upscale restaurants have started putting bread and butter on their menu as a thing that you order for like $4.
Wow. I didn't think about that. But yes, very true. And I didn't remark on it when we were at the restaurant. So
it was good, though. It was good butter. It was good bread.
I didn't eat it.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't have been wet. All right, so we've got in front of us a couple of slices of some nice rustic pain de maison from our local bakery. And I put some salted butter on the slice. So why don't you take one? It's not wet because it's not toasted.
It's not wet. Oh, boy.
And not... try the humble bread and butter.
Mm-hmm.
Take a bigger bite.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's okay. It's just not my preferred thing. I'd rather have bread.
Chips.
No. Yes, of course. Chips. Always. But with bread, I'm very fond of bread and olive oil.
Okay. So what's the difference then between olive oil and butter for you
on
bread?
It's a taste. Right now, it's the taste. Like it's pleasant, but it's a preference. I prefer the taste of olive oil with bread as opposed to butter. I like the taste of butter in while cooking, to add to other ingredients. Lovely carrots with butter and tarragon are wonderful. But butter and bread, just not my jam.
Not your pickle either. You know, there are these pickles called bread and butter pickles, kind of sweet, kind of thinly sliced, often kind of toxic yellow-green color.
No.
Yeah, well, they're called bread and butter pickles, but there's a complicated history behind why they're even called that. I just found a cool article in Savoir magazine by Eric Kim, which I'll post in the show notes. So it's a big question. Why are bread and butter pickles called bread and butter pickles? Not entirely clear.
Oh.
Yeah. So a bunch of explanations, and I'll let people read some of the fascinating answers. But it's not really even explained. It's just part of that cultural tradition of North American food language where we just call them bread and butter pickles.
Pickles. I had never heard of bread and butter pickles until now.
Yeah, well, in Quebecois French, they would be called something else. So just to test out a theory here.
Yes.
About fat on carb.
Yes.
I've got another thing for you to taste. It's a throwback to the fat episode.
Yes.
And it's some whipped lardo.
Yes.
So this is, again, just fat, like butter, on bread. What do you think of that?
But lardo is a very distinct taste, which is quite different than butter. And I'm learning to appreciate it with the first few tasting I've had since our last episode.
Yep.
But once again, it's just not my preferred taste.
Okay. So if you were to rank olive oil, lardo, and butter on bread.
Olive oil first, lardo second, butter third.
Okay. Well, I'll have to find some other fatty stuff to put on bread for you and see if we can create a much wider range of judgment. In the meantime, thanks for being my bread and butter.
You're so welcome.
À la prochaine.
Au revoir.
Back when I was a lad, I often thought about being a professional cook. I liked cooking for family and friends, and I really enjoyed the love and attention that it shone back on me. But I also worked as a cater waiter in university, and that kind of cemented a really strong sense that I just wasn't cut out for restaurant life, neither in the front nor back of house. Even so, armed with my oh-so-useful undergrad degree in chemical physics, I decided to start an independent catering company. I named it Davina Delight and focused on private dinner parties and small family events, jobs I could basically land through word of mouth.
After a year, though, I had had it. It wasn't just that catering meals via public transit was physically challenging, or that I was perpetually cooking in under-equipped private kitchens for not very large fees. What I learned about myself is that I just have very little interest cooking food I don't care about for people I don't know. I also learned that if I'm not getting an emotional payoff from cooking, the financial one has to be enormous to make it worth it for me. So today, when I go to a restaurant that doesn't really balance quality and price very well, I feel awfully conflicted. I know how hard that work is and how it's often underpaid and underappreciated, and I know how kitchens can be sites of violence, both physical and emotional. I also know that servers are subjected to very physically demanding working conditions, professional precarity, and verbal abuse. And of course, there are the tensions that abound between those who cook, those who serve and clean, and those who manage. It's all just kind of impossible. But at the same time, as a consumer with very little disposable income, I really don't want to spend what I consider to be a whole lot of money on a meal experience that's just kind of meh. I would rather stay at home and buy some fantastic local products and pour my own drinks. I'd really rather not feel rushed, or like I'm being a disruption to someone's business model, or that I'm interrupting a bartender's social life. And I particularly don't want to be lied to about an ingredient's origin or asked if I want to add a protein to my salad or taste freezer burn in my dish. That's just not the kind of restoration I'm looking for. So where are we going with the culture of restaurants? Is it paralleling the disappearance of the middle, as we're witnessing in social classes and political opinions? Are we going to be left with nothing but avant-garde tasting experiences and calorie-annotated, photo-based fast food menus? Who knows? We will just have to wait and see. And keep cooking at home and for others. From the wild and woolly world of restaurant design and kitchen dynamics, we now turn to the multitonal voice of Gabriel Darmoux as he responds to the food questionnaire. Gab is an experimental vocal artist, composer, and performer, including as Bajuria, his curious and vulnerable drag identity, inspired by South Asian culture. When we recorded Gabriel's answers to the questionnaire, he described himself as fluid, playful, and a mediator. Gabriel Darmoux, what is your idea of a perfect food?
Delicious and healthy, with satisfying textures and surprising flavor combinations.
Of what food or food context are you afraid or distrustful?
Overly and overtly chemical or industrial processed to a point of not recognizing how it ties in with nature. For example, very weirdly colorful candy, where it's mostly artificial colors or flavors. I still eat it sometimes, though.
Which food innovation do you try to ignore?
Food innovations that only very, very rich people get to enjoy. And I feel the same about fashion or high fashion. I wish I could enjoy it and engage with it or see more people be able to engage with it than actually do.
What do you consider to be an overrated food or food context?
Some quote-unquote tropical fruit when they are exported to Canada. There's a big difference between fruit in India or Trinidad, where I've been, and when I compare it with exported fruit in Canada, it's just so overrated that people would love, say, papaya here. For me, it really tastes a bit like vomit, whereas I really like it in India. And I've had the best grapefruit in Trinidad. Here, I find it too sour, and I don't particularly enjoy it.
What do you most dislike about dinner tables?
I'm not super into sitting at dinner tables. Other tables in other contexts I'm fine with.
What is the quality you most like in a fruit?
Generally, they manage to be appetizing across a broad range of situations and states of hunger. It's always time for fruit. Like I always can eat fruit. It's always good. But in terms of specific qualities, I guess softness, as in the perfectly ripe peach, or sweetly refreshing. And I particularly love pears. I think they're very underrated.
Which culinary skill would you most like to have?
I guess a more sustained sense of patience and care around cooking. sometimes I'm in the zone and I enjoy it. But in many situations, especially breakfast, I lack patience and care, and I will just eat functionally and fast.
If you were to die and come back as an edible animal, vegetable, or mineral, what would you like it to be?
My first instinct is cauliflower. I mean, I might change my mind. The question is quite thought-provoking and confronts me with mortality in a very strange way.
What is your favorite highly processed food?
Probably drumsticks, those frozen ice cream cones.
What is your favorite aroma?
There's too many.
What spice, kitchen implement, or cookbook do you use most rarely?
Caraway? I really like it, but usually it's already on some sort of caraway-themed bread. Otherwise, I rarely pull out the caraway seeds from the spice rack. Kind of the same for sumac. I love it, but I don't trust myself with its integration to stuff.
What do you most value in your friend's food?
When it's something I wouldn't have made myself.
What is your most powerful sense?
Hearing or engaging with music and with sound.
Well, thank you for sitting down at table with me for this episode of Making a Meal of It. I hope you enjoyed your time and that you'll come back soon. Mints are available in the bowl by the exit. And sincere thank yous to Stephanie Robson, Christophe Dubois, and Gabriel Darmou, as well as the man who never butters my toast but is totally my jam, Maxime Giroux. To all the restaurant designers and cooks, managers and busboys, servers and bartenders, I offer my patience and appreciation. And please remember that we all need each other for the dining out ecosystem to survive. Next week, we turn to the bubbling vat of deliciousness that is fermentation. From beer to bread, chocolate to pickles, fermentation serves many, many roles, including supporting food preservation and making things taste way different than they do in their original states. But as we'll hear from my two guests, fermenting might also foment social, environmental, and even political change. And could advanced ideas about fermentation also intersect with queer theory and feminism? But of course! Join us, won't you? In the meantime, as so many have said before, check please! L'addition, s'il vous plaît. La cuenta, por favor.